My name is Asad Ali Jaffrey. I'm the Associate Curator of Programs here at Shangri-La, Museum of Islamic Art, Culture, and Design.
Is this a full-time job?
This is more than a full-time job.
My name is Abdurrahman Malik, and for the next 10 days, I'm the artist in residence here at the Shangri-La Museum. But I come to this residency wearing a lot of different hats, so I often find it very difficult to define myself. One of the hats I wear is as a journalist. I make radio documentaries for the British Broadcasting Corporation, focusing on religion and spirituality in the modern world. And with another hat, for most of my life, I've been involved in sort of designing and implementing programs, particularly within and with Muslim communities, around sort of addressing current issues and sometimes current crises, but also in terms of harnessing the power of culture, not only to tell our stories, but to promote social justice in the broadest possible way.
Is that separate from culture, religion? How are they separate here?
You know, for me, they've never been separate, actually. They're deeply enmeshed together. I think there's often a sense that, I think there's often a sense amongst a certain type of Muslim even, that somehow religion, the canon, confessional belief, sits aside and separate from cultural production and cultural expression. But we know that the human condition is far more complex than that, and our spiritual, ethical, moral values and the context that we grow up in have a deep impact not only on the culture that we consume, but the culture that we produce. And in many ways, the next 10 days here at Shangri-La and with the Doris Duke Foundation are about exploring what that actually means. When we say Muslim culture, what do we mean? And who are not only the purveyors of that culture, but who are the producers of that culture? And I think my hope, and I don't want to speak for Asad, but our hope is that those who will be coming to the events over the next few days will leave surprised, hopefully intellectually challenged, but we also hope culturally challenged, that it'll make them think differently about the intersection between faith, spirituality, and culture.
I like all the different ways you're going at it, you know? So Asad, what does it mean to be listening like a Muslim?
So listening while Muslim is interesting, and it's something that Abdurrahman and I have talked about quite a bit. I'm a DJ, and I started DJing at probably the age of 19, so it's been a while now. And the first experience I had of what I would call listening while Muslim was through hip-hop culture. So as when I first came to the U.S. at the age of 10, I was exposed to people like Public Enemy. I was also then, when I got into high school, exposed to the Wu-Tang Clan and others that were using a lot of Islamic references, Muslim themes, whether they were from the Nation of Islam or the 5% Nation. And I quickly kind of understood the relationship between hip-hop culture and either Islam or what I would call Muslimness.
What is that relationship? Just the fact that it was mentioned, or
no? Actually, there's a really deep history that really stems from, I would say, both the Nation of Islam and the 5% Nation, and a lot of the terminology and kind of the birth of hip hop culture comes from these groups as well. A lot of the knowledge that was being shared, the cipher, for example, the circle where people would exchange rhymes or dance if there were b-boys or b-girls, really comes, that word cipher really comes from the Nation of Islam and their kind of supreme alphabet, supreme knowledge, and supreme mathematics. Interestingly enough, the word cipher itself, which is the knowledge exchange for the 5% Nation, is from the word sifr, which in Arabic means zero. So there's this interesting kind of connection between hip-hop and Islam. If you look at the earliest Afrika Bambaataa records, for example, you look at the back and it would say, all praise due to Allah. You can look at the Renegades of Funk, for example. So there was always this kind of messaging within hip-hop culture early on. Not exclusively, but a really important and formative part of it.
Even in the form of it, you know, the live form of it, you think was related to that.
Interestingly enough for me, though, as I started getting into the culture, and as a DJ, you don't just play hip-hop music. I started playing jazz and soul and funk. And as I started playing jazz and exploring more, I started realizing that there was a movement that you can take back even further. And there are several movements within black culture in the U.S. that start as early as the 1930s, but some people would say really start with the slave trade. And that is culture, usually from West Africa, if you're talking about the slave trade and blues music, or what was West African blues then influencing blues in the U.S. But even if you look at just jazz, for example, the Ahmadiyya movement that starts coming into the U.S. around the 1930s as a missionary movement starts influencing a lot of black communities in America. And you have people like Ahmad Jamal, you have people like Yusuf Lateef, you have other great jazz masters that are influenced by this. And they're not only influenced by it in a way where, well, this is my spiritual practice and then I happen to make jazz music that's great. They actually fuse those kind of understandings. A lot of it then becomes influenced with Eastern kind of modes within the music, in the example of people like Yusuf Lateef or Ahmed Abdul Malik. But then with Ahmad Jamal, even like some of his albums or the club that he opened up, Alhambra, start referencing these notions or these ideas of, again, what I would call Muslimness. You can look at Kool and the Gang. You can look at Kenny Gamble from Gamble and Huff, people that we all know. But when we think about Muslims, and especially today, we think Arabs, and we think you know, this Islamophobia and creeping Sharia, and we don't understand that right in America, the most popular music of the day is really rooted, to me, very much so in Muslimness. And so listening while Muslim, that's just a small fraction of it. Of course, we can talk about all sorts of things like Sufi music, Qawwali music from India and Pakistan, Ganawa from North Africa, and all of these things being connected and being extremely influential on Western music as well. Is really, really important, right? But we don't talk about it in that way. And so when we say, what is Muslim culture, listening while Muslim gives you a completely different insight into these music forms and these modalities.
As a Muslim person, are there certain things I like more?
Possibly. I like when Mos Def is singing Traveling Man and he says, God willing, I'm coming back to you. And then in the last little chorus, he flips it and says, Inshallah, I'm coming back to you. And as a Muslim, you're like, yeah, that's right. And I know what you're talking about, Mos. So there are little things like that that when you listen, it kind of is special to you for a certain reason, right? Nujabes, who's a producer from Japan who passed away in a car accident that a lot of people love, and I think a lot of people here in Hawaii would know that his music. He samples Yusuf Lateef, right, for a couple of his tracks. Yusuf Lateef passes away, Nujabes passes away. But listening while Muslim gives you that little feeling, knowing that he sampled Yusuf Lateef, feeling like he's sampling something that comes from Muslim culture. And we intentionally use that term to be a little bit provocative.
Someone recently sent me a Pharoah Sanders, old Pharoah Sanders video. You know, some of those guys, I don't know if they're still related to.
I think they are. And Pharoah Sanders is one of those remarkable personalities. And I mean, you know, one of the things that we've really been examining, you know, by kind of positing these, I would say, kind of disruptive ideas like listening while Muslim, is that Muslimness is as much a place from whence where culture comes and that culture is influenced and shaped by, but Muslimness is also a lens. It's a lens that we affix to the way in which that we view culture. And it reveals things that otherwise wouldn't be revealed. And I think that, for me, is not just exciting, but that, for me, opens up the possibility of all culture, in a way, being Muslim culture.
That's why I don't. You can't describe that lens to me. I have to just look at all these things and through your eyes and try to figure out what that lens is.
And hopefully through this residency to be able to share with you some of the markers, some of the milestones, some of the psychogeography, the oral geography, the sound geography that'll help you place something within a Muslim cultural frame. And I think that lens is really important. That lens, for me, not to belabor the word, is revelatory. It allows us to see things that we wouldn't otherwise see, and to understand things in a way that we wouldn't otherwise understand. I remember one of the most profound sort of cultural experiences of my life was watching the last concert by the great Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré, the last concert he gave in London. It was literally a few months before his death, and it was destined to be his last tour. And I think he had also decided that he was going to tour very little at that point, and it was unusual for him to travel. And he traveled because he and another Malian musician, Toumani Diabaté, had done an album together called The Dark Side of the Moon, which went on to win numerous awards and is considered, I think, in the last 20 years, one of the great quote-unquote world music albums. And, you know, at the beginning of that concert, packed at the Barbican Hall in London, you know, nearly 3,000 people, there was a buzz in the air. Ali Farka had come back to London, had come back to the Barbican, a stage that he'd crossed many times before. And his band started coming on, member by member, and starting to play their instruments and starting to, you know, as the music kind of built upon the music, you heard this kind of cry go out, Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammad, which means, oh God, send peace and blessings on the Prophet Muhammad. And the first song that Ali Farka chose that night to kind of, almost a swan song to the Western world that had supported him and his music so much, was a song in honor of the Prophet. And for me sitting there, I thought to myself, I wonder how many people are hearing this as I'm hearing it. Because it was with great intentionality that Ali Farka chose that. Because Ali Farka was a devout believer, a griot, a storyteller, a Sufi, some would even say a saintly man, for whom religion and spirituality and connection to God and the spirit world of his ancestors was so profound that it infused almost every aspect of his music. And here he chooses to open with the praise of the Prophet because that's who he is. He's stating his claim.
Well, you're just lucky listening while Muslim that you get that. You can feel that.
You know what the funny thing is about this conversation that we're having around what is Muslim culture? We're doing it kind of intentionally and we're being a little cheeky because people would say, well, how can you define it as this one thing anyway? And the truth is you can't. And we just want people to come away thinking that, yeah, you know what, it is complicated and you can't just understand it in a lecture in 10 days. Even in a lifetime, it's difficult because we weren't born thinking, hey, this is Muslim culture, right? As the world kind of changes and expands and as we kind of get to know each other more and more, this idea of Muslim culture evolves as well. And we're okay with that. We're not saying it stays in one time or place. We're at this space which has things from 7 centuries ago, right? Mm-hmm. But as the things evolve and change, this notion of Muslim culture, I think, evolves and changes as well. Or Muslim cultures, if you would have it. But we're intentionally now saying Muslim culture.
Because in some ways, it's organic and it's alive, isn't it? It's an ecosystem. It's not a spectrum. Often culture is talked about as a spectrum. This is the cultural spectrum. So when we define a certain type of culture, we say, well, it's on the spectrum of possibilities. And I think the word spectrum is so limiting because it limits human experience. Human experience is an ecosystem. It's organic. It's alive. We see Muslim culture as alive, organic, changing, evolving. There's those elements of culture which are kind of amoebic, which exist at the edges of the ecosystem, which are interplaying and interacting. And if you're sitting at one of the centers of the ecosystem, if you're sitting in West Africa and looking at culture in Southeast Asia, there's going to be some connective tissue, but some of it is going to be like, well, what's happening there? What's going on there? I know that there's times when I have heard a piece of music or I've heard someone speak or perform that I'm like, wow, that sounds like something that I heard in the Punjab in Pakistan. And I'll be in the Punjab in Pakistan and I'll be in Cape Town, South Africa, which was the first city and the first geography, rather, where Islam came to Southern Africa. And I can hear in Cape Town the sounds of Lahore, but I can also hear the sounds of Jakarta and Surabaya.
So people from all these places can call up something in you.
We can.
Hey, I want some of that.
And part of it is language. Part of it are the markers of language. Part of that are the markers of certain spiritual expressions. Mm-hmm. When Asad speaks about the powerful languages used in hip-hop, there's a reason why today, as our friend Hisham Aidi at Columbia University chronicles in his book Rebel Music, there's a reason why young North African Muslims born in France speak French as their first language make yearly pilgrimages to the Bronx to visit the streets where hip-hop was born is because hip-hop itself is a language. But I am certain when they hear Afrika Bambaataa or Yasiin Bey Mos Def, or when they hear Kool Moe Dee and the Wu-Tang Clan, and they hear words and they hear phrases, and all of a sudden those phrases make sense to them. And there's a geography that starts to make sense to them when Mecca is referenced and Medina is referenced. And we know that those terms have specific meaning with an American context. But the fact that they are terminologies which every Muslim would understand means that there's a connective tissue and that allows for a language and an understanding to emerge.
That's cool.
And that's powerful. That for me is profoundly powerful.
I also feel like in a way, and this is true for hip hop, but it's true in a lot of places, especially in what people call the West, is that Muslimness becomes a counterculture in a way. And so all those things that come with counterculture come into that Muslim culture realm.
Well, you mean like, taking that counterculture stance kind of puts you in a bit of a box, doesn't it? It makes you always be explaining. And that's what once I make the intellectual connection that, wow, these people are getting something I can't get because I'm not in that culture, I got to wonder, are you going to help me know what you know so that I can get that same charge when I hear what you do?
That's a good question. And as a DJ and a digger, there is this idea of like keeping things for yourself as well. It's because if you can live in that box, or if you can live in a slightly more insular community of folks, then you have this thing that others can't understand. And there is this special feeling, right? When you're sitting and you're at a concert or you're looking at something and you're like, oh, I know what that is. The problem, I think, though, really is that we all still want to connect with people and we want to connect across these boundaries that we've created. So I think for people like myself and Abdulrahman, we actually do want to get outside of that box and connect with people and be able to kind of share that understanding. And that's really important to us. I think that's why we do the work that we do. And especially because we get a lot of hate from the outside, of course, but we also get a lot of hate sometimes from within our communities. It's equally important for us to be able to kind of shift this understanding internally and externally and say that, hey, we need to be talking about these things and we don't have the right answers, but we need to be having these conversations.
In a way, it's like any great quest. You know, it's like trying to decipher the Da Vinci Code or it's trying to figure out what hieroglyphics means. In a way, once you begin to have the awareness of symbols, language, certain cultural tropes, you can start to begin to navigate. And more than that, it's about experience. I remember in the late 1990s, I was the assistant director of a teaching institute in Abiquiu, New Mexico, which was designed to teach middle and high school teachers who would teach world religions classes in the public school system to give those teachers an introduction to Islam and Muslim civilization. And it was a two-week program, and it was at this incredible retreat center up on the Mesa above Abiquiu in a center called Dar al-Islam, which itself has an incredible history and was built in the late 70s, early 80s, but as an intentional community and designed by the incredible Egyptian architect Hassan Fathi, who basically came up with this idea of architecture for the poor, that even the poorest and most marginalized people not only deserved but could build beautiful and functional buildings. So we were in this amazing retreat center, and I remember one of the sessions was an introduction to Muslim sound, and the professor who was leading that particular session played a recording of the Quran being recited at the Karawiyin University in Fez, Morocco, one of the oldest universities in the world, founded by a woman, incidentally. And the way they recite the Quran is very... I don't know how you describe it in musical language. It's incredibly rhythmic. It's incredibly rhythmic the way it's recited. It's very unique. It's very unique to the kind of the Moroccan, particularly the Fez experience of reciting the Quran. And I remember for a lot of these teachers, it was the first time they had ever heard the Quran recited. They didn't know what was being said. They didn't understand the meanings of the verses. But it was remarkable to see the reaction of these educators. And one of the teachers came up to me afterwards and said, I'm not sure what happened there, but that rhythm, she goes, it was knocking in my brain. It was hitting me somewhere deep inside, and I can't get rid of the rhythm. She says, because the rhythm moved me so much. She goes, she had goosebumps as she was listening to it. I think music and culture broadly has a visceral experiential power. And sometimes we don't know where that power comes from. Sometimes we don't understand the symbols or the particular sounds or the particular use of language that encompass it, but it's the experience. And I think part of what we're hoping to do over the next few days is to create experiences so that when you come to Listening While Muslim, you don't have to come with any knowledge except an open ear and to allow yourself to experience music that you may never heard before, but some music which you may never have heard like this before. And I think that experience is really important. And I think culture and receiving culture is, of course, deeply experiential. And the best culture is the culture that we embody, is the culture that we take into ourselves, the culture that we filter through our own experiences, and that changes us, that forces us to question or explore. I think that's what we're trying to do. Maybe unlock some of those silos.
I wonder about the avant-garde in that context. I've seen a lot of the videos and stuff.
I've been at Yale University since last August, and this year one of the research projects that I had taken on was loosely titled In Search of an Islamic Avant-Garde. And I know it's something that Asad is intimately aware of and related to, because it's been a topic of conversation that we've had for many, many years, is understanding Islamic art and culture beyond the traditional or classical arts. Arts that surround us in many ways here at Shangri-La, Islamic geometry and calligraphy and the tile work and the incredible carpets and the traditional arts that surround us. I think those arts are incredibly important. But culture is, as we said, an organism. It's something that's changing, adapting, evolving. I've always been interested in what are the margins of what we think Islamic art is or should be. There are people who've written books, tomes, telling us what Islamic art is and what Islamic art isn't. And I want to leave that work aside, not ignore it, but let's set it aside for a moment and let's think about what Islamic art and culture could be. And the term avant-garde for me is less of a kind of a term connected to a historic movement, but it's a term which I think has a unique definition for me, which is this notion of the shock of the new, of something that is disruptive, something that might even be subversive, something which changes and alters what we think the possibilities of art could have been and allows us to think about what the possibilities of art could be and, frankly, should be.
Have you seen anything like that?
I have, and
I haven't.
Tomorrow night's lecture we'll be talking about it. But I'll give you one example. Mm-hmm. Example that's very close to Asad and I, because one of our friends, Abbas Zahidi, is a master's student at Central Saint Martin's College in London, England, and he was one of a select group of young artists of color who are from diasporic communities. His family is Iranian, but he grew up in Britain. Who exhibited at the Venice Biennale. And places like the Venice Biennale are places which we celebrate as places of new, bold, subversive, disruptive artistic traditions. And here is Abbas Zahedi, a young Muslim Iranian man from the West End of London, where he grew up literally in the hood, where the council housing is, incredibly multicultural. His friends are Moroccan and Pakistani and Somali. And Abbas is this brilliant artist who thinks very deeply about issues around diasporic identities. And so he has this whole idea around neo-diaspora, which we're going to talk a little bit about at the session here at Shangri-La. But I would say an artist like Abbas Zahedi, who did a site-specific piece at the Venice Biennale, and what he did was he created or recreated and imagined the living room of his multi-generational family. Because as he began to explore his own personal history, he realized that his family were essentially winemakers. And they were winemakers in a Muslim cultural environment. And if you were to think about wine and alcohol broadly, people would say, well, you know, alcohol is forbidden in Islam. How is it that in Iran, a country that we associate today with theocracy and fundamentalism, how could it be that in Iran there was a tradition, not just a business, a tradition of making alcohol, but there was. And that begins to disrupt our sense of how Muslims express their Muslimness. And so what Abbas did essentially was recreate a space where his family would have gathered and what were the influences that were gathering there. And part of what he did as part of his work at the Venice Biennale was he actually brewed a drink, which he called the Saffron Shandy, a drink which has no saffron in it at all. But it was called the Saffron Shandy. He trained at a brewery for over 2 years to learn the art of brewing. And when he offered this drink as part of the experience that he was cultivating at the Venice Biennale, immediately the reaction came, well, oh, I thought you were coming from a Muslim culture. I thought this was connected to Iran. And there was a sense of, well, should you even be doing this? As an artist, of course, not only did he do it, he can do it, and he has every right to do it. And by doing that, you begin to sort of disrupt ideas. There is a shock of the new. There's a sense of, I never knew this before. I don't understand this culture through this lens before. What does that have to do with diaspora? It has everything to do with diaspora, because we take certain ideas with us. Some of them are encoded in us. Some of them are, some of them emerge over time as we go through the struggles of being and becoming who we are. There is an incredible breadth of contemporary cultural and artistic production that is happening around the world. And, you know, when people like Asad and I speak about Muslim culture, not only are we speaking about it as an ecosystem, but we're speaking about it as a space that is not a quote-unquote Muslim-only space. It's a space where people will self-identify as Muslim. It's a space where contexts that are influenced by Muslim and Islamic histories, languages, ethnic traditions are important, and therefore art and culture that emerges from that has to contend with that all around it. And there are those, of course, who may not have any confessional affiliation at all, but work specifically with Muslim or Islamic themes or themes that connect within that ecosystem. For me, that is incredibly powerful, because what that says to me is that Muslim culture isn't the domain of those who are confessionally Muslim, but Muslim culture, for us, imagines an ecosystem that is vast enough to contain multiple confessional and non-confessional affiliations. There's an artist in...
But not people just quoting Muslim culture, right?
Exactly.
Or what?
And also engaging with it.
Well, I think if you're going to explain Muslim culture as an ecosystem, right, I think the important thing to say is that the ecosystem is not closed.
No.
It's an open ecosystem, and it's an ecosystem which people travel through.
But I remember this down. Someplace in your You said it was, you don't have to be Muslim to create Muslim culture.
Yeah.
Hello?
Those are his words. You know, I think historically speaking, Islamic art has been defined by region and by era, usually, right? And then when we think about contemporary, what we're calling Islamic art, what does that mean then? Are we, obviously we're talking about something that's contemporary, but we still kind of regionalize it a little bit, and it's difficult for people to understand what that means because then it defaults to specific regions. So I think what we're trying to say with the avant-garde is that now people are kind of doing their, are self-identifying and kind of taking agency of it rather than scholars and academics and even curators, but are rather defining for themselves, right? And because it's harder now to put people in these boxes of, well, you're from this particular region, and so you must create things that come from that region. People are mixing up the idea of what it means to create what we're calling Muslim culture. And so, yeah, I'll let you talk a little bit more about how do you create Muslim culture and not have to be Muslim.
You know, one of the greatest early sort of edifices of Islam spread from the Arabian Peninsula across what we would now term the Middle East, particularly the Levant, was when Islam came to Damascus. And under the Umayyad dynasty, which was the first significant dynasty after the time of the Prophet Muhammad, the Umayyad dynasty built a mosque, which is still called the Umayyad Mosque, and it's at the very heart of old Damascus. But if you look at the walls of the Umayyad Mosque, you will see incredible frescoes, murals, mosaics of vegetation and natural beauty. That was all done by Christian artisans. Those frescoes, those mosaics, part of what we would call Muslim culture, even though it was created by Christians from a tradition that was essentially a tradition that was that found its home within Christian communities, that is as part of Muslim culture to me as the mosque itself, because the two things meld in that particular place, in that particular context, in Damascus and in the Levant. Hip-hop is an amazingly interesting place where people who aren't Muslim are constantly co-opting or utilizing or participating in or taking ownership of Muslim culture and the terms that come out of movements like the Nation of Islam, like the 5% movement, but even broadly out of Sunni Islam or Ahmadiyya Muslim traditions or individuals like Malcolm X, who inspired the Black Arts Movement.
Do you see, is that a wave breaking? I mean, is this?
I don't know if it's a wave breaking. I feel that it's been, these are cultural processes that have been work a very long time. When Asad speaks about the experience of the transatlantic passage and enslavement, and we think about what scholars are telling us now, that 30 to 40% of those who came across the ocean in chains were Muslim. And we have evidence, which is now recorded in places like the Smithsonian, particularly at the New Museum of African American History, where we know that slaves, or those enslaved rather, were speaking Arabic alongside their languages, their native languages. And they were writing texts in the Arabic language, and that they were continuing to try and pray, and that those modes of prayer and religious expression then get encoded into the hollers and the songs and the moans that were recorded by ethnomusicologists in the 1800s initially. And we listen to those, and we see the connective tissue between them, between those forms of music, particularly the blues, and West African modalities of music. We're in a different place now. I would go so far as to say that if you are playing the blues, you're engaged in the ecosystem of Muslim culture. If you are a jazz musician, you are engaged in the ecosystem of Muslim culture. If you are doing hip-hop, you can't be doing the hip-hop that you are doing without the pioneers of that art form. You couldn't do hip-hop without the lost poets.
Or you wouldn't be drinking coffee either.
And we would, you know, what's interesting is
we would be drinking coffee if it wasn't for Muslim culture, and we wouldn't have Starbucks if it wasn't for the coffee shops of Istanbul and Damascus and Aleppo. And I think what it does for me as well in this particular political moment in the United States of America is to say that no country is an island, and that we, particularly in the United States, we should be keenly aware of the fact that this nation has been shaped by profound cultural influences. And at the heart of those cultural influences, alongside all the other ones, there are Muslim cultural influences. And some of those have been carried through ethno-linguistic or particular cultural forms. But underneath that, there is symbolism and language which connects it broadly to Islam and Muslim culture. Islam is as American as apple pie.
You know, a while ago, a Malaysian Dikir Barat artist had come to the U.S., and he had come because he wanted to discover the roots of the blues because of its specific connection back to Islam in some way. And he went to the blues musicians of the day, the contemporary blues legends, people like Buddy Guy and others, who themselves may not have been that deeply involved in those roots, but he saw that connection there, right? As somebody coming from halfway across the world and wanted to come and make this documentary that is out there
and
available.
Who is this guy? Because I'm going to have to play some music that makes this connection.
I will find his name and send it to you.
Okay.
I have an email from him from when he came to town. But the other thing that I'll say from just personal anecdotal experience is that for at least a decade, maybe 15 to 20 years, even before 9/11, because a lot of people like to use that as a reference point, this idea of being Muslim in different various communities was this counterculture, right? And young kids thought it was cool to be Muslim. So, for example, in 1992, when the Malcolm X Spike Lee movie came out, a lot of the kids in my high school that were, you know, maybe throwing up gang signs at some point started wearing X hats and saying assalamu alaikum to each other. Because it was a cool thing to do within hip-hop culture, but it was also the cool thing to do within kind of black culture that was becoming popularized around this kind of resurgence of Malcolm X. By the way, about 20 years later, if you go to Lahore, you'll see a lot of air fresheners in rickshaws and taxis. They're the exact same axe that was the Malcolm X, not because of Malcolm X, but somehow that symbology goes back to a country that is predominantly Muslim, but that's a side note. But interestingly enough, in the 90s and in the 2000s, a lot of young people, a lot of the work that was being done at different organizations like the Inner City Muslim Action Network, Iman, were putting on cultural productions that young people wanted to be a part of that had nothing to do with Islam or they weren't Muslim themselves, but they thought something that was cool in there. When they saw people like Amir Suleiman on the HBO Deaf Poetry Jam, when they heard Mos Def using terms, when Lupe Fiasco starts doing it, when a slew of other people, there's this connection, and they want to emulate that. So the style that they're doing things in is very much the same style as these Muslim artists or these cultural productions are doing things in. And they're talking to the same similar audiences, and they're trying to mimic that behavior in order to also be a part of this community, and also to be part of a community that's really kind of working around social justice. So linking different movements that are happening right now in America that are kind of talking about immigrants, refugees, Muslimness, Black Lives Matters, LGBTQ movements, and kind of saying, like, well, if we're going to be in this, it's got to be justice for all, so we're going to embrace the Muslim aspect of it. And, of course, it happens to be that Muslim culture is deep-rooted as well, just like others. And so when cultural production happens or somebody's performing or doing something, people want to be a part of that as well. And it helps that Muslim culture can also be a part of all these other things, right? Mm. There isn't a difference necessarily that says, well, this is Muslim culture and this is black culture, because there's overlaps there as well. And there's not only overlaps, there's deep history there. So interesting.
And I think for us, I mean, the centrality of black culture is that it carried, it is almost fused with Muslim culture. And in fact, I mean, I think probably for both of us, but certainly my own sort of cultural education has almost entirely come from, an African-American Islamic experience. You know, I have my own, the cultural forms that I grew up with, and, you know, having parents from the subcontinent, and those were very, very important. And the ones that we experienced at a mosque that was largely made up of a diverse set of immigrants from around the world. But I don't think it was until I really became introduced to African-American Islam and the history of black Muslims in America, which is synonymous with the history of blackness in America, that you begin to realize, and that was so important for me to recognize that deep in the soil of the Americas lies the blood of millions of Muslims, that anything this country is was shaped by black bodies, many of whom were confessionally Muslim, who had their, not only their freedom, their history, their culture, their religion ripped away from them, like all those who came in chains. And that the emergence of a particular Islamic expression in America is because of that history. And the way that history has been so resilient and has emerged. And I think we in the United States are incredibly blessed, because right now we have scholars, and we have those who are, I think, doing the deep dive into these areas and topics. And not only in terms of the cultural production side, but also in terms of the intellectual production side. People like Suad Abdul Khabir, for instance, or Sohail Dolatzai, or Hisham Aidi, or Bilal Ware, Edward Curtis. You know, these are really important intellectual personalities who are, as we speak, not just shaping a new narrative, but are actually defining historical, a historical force that is manifesting itself in American society today in a variety of ways. And the lens that we're looking at is culture.
Yeah. What is Muslim culture? Thanks for pointing out so many ways that it's in our roots. I mean, I wonder, how am I going to feel it? How, you know, are you all really glad that hummus is so common in the supermarkets now? You know, that kind of thing.
Only when
shisha
it's
shisha bars. We got them in Hawaii, you know. Yeah. I mean, is this a good thing? Is this a part of it? Is this part of it?
Look,
how can I get closer to that?
I don't know how you feel about it, Asad, but I mean, I think we've always contended that culture cannot be controlled. I think at times it can be influenced, it can be shaped, it can be manipulated, but ultimately you can't control it. culture has a way of seeping through the rocks and through the nooks and crannies and finding its own kind of path into things. So it is fantastic that you can get hummus everywhere. As a avid shisha smoker, I'm always extremely happy when there is a good shisha joint close by. But I'm also aware that these, as a cultural organizer, our entry points are places that we can begin to have a conversation. So if we can start a conversation with hummus, all the power to us. Or we can have a conversation over a Hubble Bubble, all good. Only because if those are entry points into sort of cultural frames that are that we might not have thought about before, I think that's totally fine.
You know what? I would argue, would you ask a Hindu that if they're happy that yoga is all over the place, and what would their response be, right? And so I think it's kind of a nuanced thing. It's kind of it can be troublesome sometimes. There is this aspect of cultural appropriation and watering down of things that could be really good, right?
And America is very good at orientalizing.
Yeah.
And orientalism. So the things become stereotypical and cartoonish.
Right.
And going back to what you were saying, I was also heavily influenced by black culture in America growing up, and that's what made me allowed me to connect back to my own roots. Honestly, I didn't like being an Indian Pakistani kid because in Kuwait I was made fun of for being it, and then when I came to the U.S., people didn't understand, and even Muslims were made fun of. But hip hop really gave me that, and then beyond those forms as well. But I had to connect back to my own roots. I had to love the music that I grew up on, like Qawwali music. I had to love my own South Asian roots in order for me to love everybody else, right? That time had to come. And I think it's about being authentic to yourself. So that's what allowed me to connect to my Lakota brothers and sisters or my Choctaw brothers and sisters and learn their spiritual kind of nuances and culture that's kind of all-encompassing and I think a great example for us as Americans. Mm. And allowed me to have this all-encompassing idea that I can be just as steeped in hip-hop culture as part of Muslim culture as I can in Sufi music culture from South Asia or from West Africa, or that I can be in perhaps enjoying some really good homemade hummus. But it has to connect, right? Because I understood why the sweat lodge was important to the fancy dancer, was important to the fry bread on the res, but that was also important in talking about the high suicide rates and what had happened and why the American Indian movement was important. All of those things had to come together to make a story, just like they have to come together for us. So if we just take little pieces of it and people are wearing things that, you know, reference indigenous Americans in some way on their shirts because Polo Ralph Lauren is making them, that's one thing, right? And maybe we're not going to be happy about that. But if you can understand that entire movement and that entire culture, then it kind of changes your perspective. And I think we can all do that in some way. We just have to take one step further towards the other, and then one step internally to kind of understanding where we're coming from as well and our own lens.
And I think that
thanks for making it a little more fun.
And there's humility, isn't there? That knowing that that when you approach cultural forms or understandings, that we approach those with a sense of humility, and not with a sense of appropriation, and that in that engagement, actually, that's a resistance. Engaging with humility, I think, is part of our resistance because it honors the thing that we're engaging with, and also honors where we're coming from. You know, one of the events that we're going to be doing over the next few days here is a story circle with a wide variety of people who live on these islands, particularly in Oahu, and we're going to be engaging with indigenous Hawaiians, if I can use that terminology, and kind of beginning to explore what notions and ideas of home. You know, I find often in my own personal experience that I feel like a bit of a global cosmopolitan nomad, at home, everywhere and nowhere, being able to sort of navigate in and out of airports and arrive in places and sort of feel a sense of belonging, maybe if even that's ersatz and sort of fabricated for the moment. But that really, the modern cosmopolitanism really contrasts in many ways with indigenous ideas of place and belonging and ancestors and land and sky, which is physically located. And I'm really fascinated by trying to understand if these competing or varying notions of home and how we find home are actually reconcilable. I think that speaks to what you were saying, Asad, around sort of authenticity and engaging with others with a sense of humility and understanding, because you kind of know where you're coming from. And once there's a confidence about being grounded, we're better able to engage with the other, because it's not on the basis of fear, it's on the basis of expanding our vision. And as a believer, I would say that is at the very heart of what it means for me to be a believing Muslim, because as a believer, if I believe that everything has a divine origin, then everything demands respect, and demands my time, and demands judiciousness, and demands listening, and demands silence, and demands learning. If I'm going to understand and seek to understand the divine in all the divine's majesty and diversity, then I have to do so with a strong dose of understanding that I only approach a little bit of it. I have a smudge of the picture, and the picture is much much larger than that. So, in many ways, I think for some of us, the work of culture is actually a profoundly spiritual. It's a profoundly spiritual work, and I would certainly say that in my own experience of my own spirituality, culture is vital to expressing my Muslimness and my faith, and the two are connected, deeply connected. So in some ways, not for everyone, but for me, and a residency like this one at Doris Duke is actually part of a practice. Is almost part of a spiritual practice, because it forces us to ask ourselves deep and fundamental questions about who we are and what shapes us and what makes us human, in the image of and the creative image of the divine. So those are there. I think this is at one level incredibly fun work, but it's also, I think, incredibly profound work.
And that's some adventurous programming there. That home the party. What do you hope to get to there?
At that specific event? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of times we have residencies and there's a lot of public-facing things that happen and people are having discussions and conversations, but it sometimes becomes a one-way thing, right? So we think about, well, how do we do workshops? And then workshops are usually with younger people or they're hands-on and you're learning something. But we thought because Abdulrahman is a storyteller, it would be good for us to share stories. And what better stories to share than those about belonging and home, especially because I'm very new here myself. A lot of people at Shangri-La are new, but also if you think about Shangri-La itself, how does this place exist here? And what is its place here? Why did it come to exist? And how do these things belong in their quote-unquote new home, even though they've been here for 80 years now? How they interact with the environment and the challenges that they have. And I think that can be said of us too, and all of us as people. So I think it's just really more for learning and for kind of mutual understanding. And almost as an excuse for our guests, our artists in residence, to be able to learn from people who live here, who've been born and raised here, who may have been here for generations or may just have come when their parents came over. And I think it can just give us insight into how we can better connect around a really fundamental idea of home.
Yeah. Hawaii is all about place. That's beautiful, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. It's a great primer for us for things that are coming up.
It is a great primer.
I was like, oh, yeah, this is what we're doing.
This is actually, work prep.
This is this is great prep. You gave us an excuse to while we're running around.
Now you can have the rest of the day in the water.
I know that's what my son wants. He's.